It's been a dramatic week of revelations in the impeachment inquiry, where diplomacy has been threatened.
We want the president to be conducting foreign policy for the good of the nation, not for his own personal interests.
Also today, we go to Lebanon, where protests began as an uprising against attacks. They become something much bigger.
This is a war between the people who have nothing anymore. They have nothing anymore to lose. And the other side is the system.
And how do you get Argentines to understand their financial crisis? Make funny videos about the economy and post them on Instagram.
It's better to say something funny and right instead of look at the camera and say, oh, that's really bad.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for making it here this Friday. This has been a whirlwind week of impeachment and Ukraine news, and now a new investigation into the Department of Justice. It's exhausting trying to keep up, but we're here to make it easy for you. Joining me are Michael McFaul, former U.S. ambassador to Russia, and lawyer and author Terry Canfield. Thanks to you both for being here. To you first, Terry. Before we get into the details, let's start at 35,000 feet. If you could put it into one sentence, what's the central concern of constitutional scholars and lawyers like you with the conduct of this administration in this affair? What is it?
The overarching issue is public corruption and a United States president trading foreign policy for his own personal gain.
All right. If it's not so obvious, I mean, why is that a big deal?
Why is that a big deal? Well, it's to begin with, the framers of the Constitution were particularly concerned about a president being beholden to foreign interests or a foreign government interfering in the United States. Basically, when we have an election, we want the American people to vote for the president. We don't want foreign governments to be selecting our president. And when the president of the United States conducts foreign policy, we want the president to be conducting foreign policy for the good of the nation, not for his own personal interests.
So it's corruption intersecting with foreign policy. Ambassador McFaul, what's your overriding concern?
Well, the same thing. The use of a public office for private gain. That's the essence of what happened here. And let's spell that out with a few more specifics. What President Trump and his team did, his three amigos, as they've been referred to, and Mr. Giuliani and some other lieutenants that they hired to do this, they tried to get the Ukrainian government to investigate alleged corruption by Hunter Biden, the Vice President Biden's son, as a way to gain, you know, leverage and something to use in the 2020 election. They also want them to investigate alleged Ukrainian interference in the 2016 election. And in return for that, the quid pro quo was that they would lift the freeze that they put on military assistance to Ukraine, and they would give President Zelensky a meeting in the Oval Office. So it was a trade of something public that has to do with American national security for President Trump's personal reelection efforts.
Yes. And could I add something to that? You mentioned quid pro quo. Just asking the Ukrainians to conduct the investigation is a legal violation.
Mm. Mike McFaul, a lot of commentators are singling out the testimony this past Tuesday of Bill Taylor, the acting ambassador to Ukraine, as especially significant. Some saying, a smoking gun. What have you heard and why is that?
Well, so first of all, I've known Bill Taylor for three decades. I want to fully disclose that. I worked with him a bit and interacted with him over decades of work that he's done. He's done all kinds of jobs for the United States government for over 50 years, first as an infantryman in Vietnam. And that matters. That gives him a lot of credibility in my world. He's worked for Democrats and Republicans, and he was appointed to be our ambassador in Ukraine back in 2006 under President Bush. And what Bill did is he just very meticulously outlined what the scheme, I'm not going to call it a quid pro quo, but whatever the deal done, I'll actually use what John Bolton called it. He called it a drug deal, the National Security Advisor. And what he said, when he saw what was going on, when he was asked to become our acting ambassador, to replace, by the way, the former ambassador who was pushed out by Mr. Giuliani because she was trying to block this very drug deal.
Maria Ivanovich.
He looked at it. Maria Ivanovich, excuse me, he said, I'm not going to have any part of it. And he then spelled out in his public testimony that we've now read exactly what they were trying to do. And by the way, it's clear to me, as lots of Foreign Service officers are trained to do, by the way, that he took meticulous notes throughout this place. So he has actual quotes of the various players here that he then presented before the committee. And that's why I think his testimony has been so damning.
So, Terry or Mike McFaul, what are the dots to connect between what's going on with the impeachment inquiry and looking into these ties to Ukraine and this news yesterday that the DOJ is going to launch this criminal inquiry into the origins of the Mueller investigation? Are there dots to connect?
Do you want to go ahead or I can try to answer?
Go ahead.
Well, I think the dots are, again, it's a distraction and it's an attempt to create an alternate narrative. So what's coming out of Taylor's testimony is very devastating to the president, right? Taylor documented and backed it up with corroborating evidence that, in fact, the Trump administration was behaving corruptly in Ukraine. And so by launching a criminal investigation against somebody else, it's a way of saying, no, 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 they're the bad guys, which is a way of saying, well, we're all corrupt. So you may as well stick with your homegrown corrupt official instead of the enemy corrupt official.
The president and his team are pushing back on a number of fronts. In particular, they say every president uses private back channels to conduct foreign policy. What is wrong inherently with Trump using Rudolph Giuliani, for example, as, you know, an emissary for one of those back channels?
Actually, that's not true. I served in the government for 5 years. I don't remember a single back channel person that we had. And, you know, every now and then, presidents deputize somebody for hostage crises or things like that. But it's just not true. And in fact, what you have in the Trump administration is, you know, they're going around the normal channels of government precisely because they know that they're doing things that the rest of the government will not support.
So a final thought from you both, one or two words describing what you'll both be looking for in the coming week.
I think one of the reasons why I think the Republicans are very frustrated right now is because they don't know what's going on behind closed doors. And so they're not able to, in their words, get their messaging targeted, messaging spin, you might say. And so they're flailing right now. And I'll be looking to see when the public hearings begin, what happens.
Ambassador?
Well, I don't actually think we need any more information. I think we don't need to hear from the whistleblower. It'll be nice to have bits and pieces filled in by other people testifying. But I think the facts here are clear as day. The president used his public office and taxpayer money as a way to leverage dirt on his Democratic challenger. And then he dragged a bunch of U.S. government officials into it and then tried to conceal his actions. That's the story. Whether it's an impeachable offense or not, that's not an area that I claim expertise in. But that it was wrong, that it should not happen, I think is clear. And so I hope people just keep focusing on that core thing that happened that is indisputable and not get lost in the weeds about these various things, you know, that have been happening. That's why you, Marco, rightly wanted to say at the end of the week, let's go to 30,000 feet. That's the story at 30,000 feet. And the question moving forward, the only question moving forward to me are there Republican senators, because I think the president will be impeached, are there Republican senators that believe that that so-called drug deal was an offense that demands the removal of the president?
Former U.S. Ambassador to Russia Michael McFaul and lawyer, author, and historian Terry Canfield, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us. Bye-bye.
For the ninth straight day, Lebanon streets are flooded with protesters. The demonstrations began in Beirut, anger over a proposed tax on WhatsApp phone calls. Things quickly spread into more general anger about the economic structure in Lebanon and the ruling elite there. Nada Nassif is a political activist in Beirut with the organization Lehaki, that translates to My Rights. I connected with Nada through WhatsApp, something that could have cost her money if the protests had not erupted.
We're protesting against economic policies that affects directly the low and middle classes. They affect the working classes. And these policies do not touch, actually, anything related to the rich class. And I'm saying rich class because the people in Lebanon, the majority of the rich class in Lebanon is the politicians and their families and the people who benefit from this system. So basically, we are protesting against a system, an entire system
Well, apparently the Lebanese government heard that and approved a series of economic reforms, including halving the salaries of ministers and members of parliament. That was earlier this week. But the protests continue. Why did those reforms not satisfy you and the other protesters?
The entire government since the 1990s have been the same. Even if the faces change, the movements who constitute the government are still the same. They did nothing but to make the rich richer and the poor poorer. And any reforms that were done in 72 hours are a lie. And we know that 2.5 million people in Lebanon and so many more in diaspora are saying that we do not trust our government or the corrupt system.
So the leader of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, he praised you protesters in a speech today and attributed the economic crisis to decades of poor economic management. And yet Hezbollah is allied with the government.
Yes.
So are you worried about who you're protesting against? Are you also protesting against Hezbollah?
We are protesting against them all, and we are very clear about this. Hezbollah was part of the resistance to the in face of the Zionist state, and we understand that. However, they will never use their history to scare us. We are proud of the history of the resistance. However, you cannot use it anymore to protect the government and to protect the system. You are part of it. You need to take your responsibility.
So Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, it was also interesting to see him speaking without a Hezbollah flag behind him and only a Lebanese national flag. And yet videos coming out of Beirut are showing Hezbollah supporters beating up protesters. So, I mean, where does Hezbollah stand in all of this?
I'd be very courageous in stating this. What they are trying to do, actually, is very simple. They will say that they are with the protest. They will show people that they will make people listen to what Nasrallah has to say. But people are not afraid. I'm not only targeting Hezbollah, I'm targeting all of them because they are all part of it. It is very important for the world to listen to this. This is a war between the people who have nothing anymore. They have nothing anymore to lose. And the other side is the system. They are trying to make to scare us. This is not working.
You know, it strikes me that a lot of the lines of the Lebanese story are the same lines that are coursing through Chile right now. I'm just wondering how you feel connected to other activists around the globe, whether it's Chile or Hong Kong or in Barcelona.
I'll tell you, we are inspired by the revolutions, by the Arab Spring that started in Tunisia. We are inspired by Sudan. There are a lot of, there's a bad scene in front of me.
What are you saying?
People from Hezbollah are hitting the protesters.
Right now?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes.
Where are you? Are you in a safe space? Do you need to get out of the way?
Yeah, I'm in my car. It's fine. I'm in my car.
Yeah, I think it's just a sign of how tense things really are there.
Sir, we had some festivities, yes. And right now the scene is not festive at all.
Given how quickly things change with these protests, how long will you be demonstrating?
I don't know, till the resignation of the government. It's very clear for us.
Nada Nassif in Beirut, thank you very much for your time. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you, Marco. Thank you.
Take care. Stay safe.
Thank you. I will try my best. Bye-bye.
After that interview, we followed up with Nada. She says she's a little shaken up by what she saw just there, but said she's doing fine and passed along a message of hope for Lebanon. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the world. In recent weeks, the wave of global protests has spread to South America, to Ecuador and Chile. Argentines are watching with a wary eye, worried that their own economic crisis could tip their country into unrest. National elections are Sunday, and Argentine voters may bring back a familiar party to guide the nation. Catherine Osborne has that story from Buenos Aires.
Peronism, the leftist populist movement that dominated Argentina on and off since the 1940s, has more recently become known for corruption and division. In Argentina's last election in 2015, voters rejected the handpicked successor to outgoing Peronist president Cristina Kirchner.
If I had to make a football metaphor, I would say Cristina is Diego Maradona.
Argentine journalist Martin Shapiro says she's as polarizing as soccer great Maradona.
People just love Maradona, or they deeply dislike Maradona, but there are no grace when you speak about Maradona with someone in Argentina. And I believe it's the same for Cristina.
Kirchner raised welfare benefits for poor families and prosecuted historic abuses by Argentina's military. But she also ran up the budget deficit and was charged with corruption. Argentines have long wondered if she would run for president again. This year, in what's been called a master stroke, she shelved those ambitions to run for vice president alongside fellow Peronist Alberto Fernandez. He's a low-profile but widely respected moderate. One of his colleagues likens him to another Argentine soccer player, midfielder Javier Mascherano. Shapiro explains.
In our most successful World Cup in 20 years, which was the 2014 one, Javier Mascherano was arguably the most important player of the team. Messi was the brilliant one, but Javier Mascherano was the one who organized the team, the one who acted like manager inside those field, and his silent work, his silent contribution was probably even more important than Messi's.
According to the polls, Alberto Fernandez is winning over hundreds of thousands of Argentines who voted for the right-wing free market incumbent, Mauricio Macri, in the last election. Taxi driver Jose Spinelli says he's deeply disappointed in Macri.
Bueno, esta vez quería un cambio, lo voté a Macri porque creía en el cambio.
Macri promised a change, but ended up governing for his rich friends, says Spinelli.
Alberto es un tipo muy inteligente, lo veo muy tranquilo, capaz.
Alberto Fernandez seems like a very smart, capable guy, he says. But he's voting for Fernandez not only because of who he is, but also his approach to one of Argentina's biggest challenges.
Fondo Monetario Internacional.
During his tenure, Macri signed off on a massive bailout loan from the International Monetary Fund to shore up Argentina's lagging economy. It came with steep austerity cuts. And now Argentina's economy is predicted to shrink by more than 3% this year. So many Argentines blame Macri for the situation that Fernandez is predicted to win the election by as much as 15 points, potentially avoiding a runoff. Observers say the bigger drama will come afterward. Argentina has to repay more than $50 billion next year. President Macri had argued that his business background would attract investors to Argentina.
Macri said it's going to rain investment, and it didn't happen.
Estefania Pozu is an economic journalist. She says the current crisis has many Argentines scrambling to get a better grasp of complex economic policy. She's part of a team that posts short videos about the economy on Instagram.
If you repeat and repeat and repeat the terms of the financial market and don't understand what really means, it's difficult to question it.
Humor is also helpful for understanding the situation, she says.
It's better to say something funny and right instead of look at the camera and said, oh, that's really bad.
She says the likely Fernandez victory would give him authority to demand a different relationship with international creditors. Best case, Argentina can relax its austerity and have more time to repay. Worst case, it could plunge into social unrest, like some of its South American neighbors are experiencing now. For The World, Catherine Osborne, Buenos Aires.
France unveiled the logo for the 2024 Paris Olympics this week, and it has caused quite a reaction. The World's Jessica Yarmosky has that story.
Let's start with the logo itself. It's a gold circle overlaid with a white flame, but it's also a woman's face, complete with pouty lips and a sleek bob haircut.
The gold medal, the flame, Marianne.
By the way, Marianne is the symbol of the French Republic. She's been typically depicted as noble and strong, but that's not the direction the designers went this time.
You have the whole of human achievement that's supposed to be summed up by these Olympic Games, and you go with like this smiling face with a cute haircut.
That's Megan Clement. She's a journalist who's been covering gender and politics in Paris for the past 4 years, and she thinks the logo is silly.
It just plays into every outdated stereotype of what it means to be a French woman and French womanhood.
It's the French girl stereotype, a woman who's thin, white, chic, with impeccable skin. You know, like Catherine Deneuve. Clement says when she saw the logo, she mined every stereotype of a Parisian woman she could think of and turned to Twitter, where she narrated a day in the life of the logo.
The French Olympic logo tumbles out of bed on a Parisian morning. She twistles her messy bob, dons Breton stripes and ballet flats, and whisks down the stairs from her fifth floor apartment to grab a baguette before enigmatically texting two men who are pursuing her romantically.
That one got thousands of likes. And for all you parents out there, take note. The logo's kid is much better behaved than yours.
The French Olympic logo's child does not have tantrums. He eats dinner with her in restaurants at 10 p.m., and the French Olympic logo lets him have some of her wine, of course.
Of course, this is a parody. Clement says none of her French friends, or anyone she's met in France, actually lives up to these stereotypes. That's what's so frustrating. She says even though France has become incredibly diverse in almost every way, race, ethnicity, religion, body type, it just won't let go of its French girl stereotype. I mean, it was only 4 years ago that this safety video was shown on Air France flights.
Welcome aboard, ladies and gentlemen.
It's narrated by a thin woman with a classic brown bob. And here's where five slender, attractive women wearing striped sweaters and ballet flats march out and start showing you where the exits are located.
Whenever the seatbelt sign is on, your seatbelt.
And yes, apparently your seatbelt will
elegantly highlight your waistline while ensuring your safety.
That video caused quite a backlash in France, by the way. As for the logo, some people were pleased with it. For one, it's the first time it will be shared by both the Olympics and the Paralympics, which many see as a sign of inclusion. And French Olympic fencer Yazora Tibou seemed excited by the idea of female representation. She tweeted, "The new logo for Paris 2024 is a woman, in all caps." But Clement isn't convinced that just the presence of a woman, even if it's supposed to be Marianne, is enough.
I mean, I think strong women have faces and eyes and do things.
Logo designers, take note. For The World, I'm Jessica Yarmosky.
Still to come on the show, investigators in Indonesia have released a report about what led to last year's Lion Air crash. We spoke with one pilot who is frustrated. Stay with us. You're with The World. Career diplomats are standing up to the president, and future Foreign Service officers are watching.
If we find a point that we're unable to ethically carry out, morally carry out these commands, then we have the responsibility to recuse ourselves or resign.
Bureaucrats fight back. Healthy for democracy or a troubling trend? That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRI, and PRX. Over the past 2 weeks, diplomats have taken center stage in Washington. They're actually defying a White House order not to cooperate with the House impeachment inquiry. Call it the revenge of the bureaucrats, many of whom have either been pushed aside or denigrated by the president. So Foreign Service officers are getting their day in court, as it were. But what impact could all of this have on the future of the profession? Here in Boston, we happen to have two of the top schools in the country for diplomats. The World's Rupa Shenoy paid them a visit.
Before Mojib Hasnavi was even born, he says American diplomats saved his family.
I'm sure they're very specific individuals that are part of my story that I've never met.
Those Foreign Service officers got his parents out of Russia and Afghanistan. Hasnavi was the first in his family to be born and raised in the U.S.
I don't take that privilege lightly. And I think that's kind of the beauty of the Foreign Service, is that it's this selfless career path. Well, I'll probably never meet these people that granted the visa stamps to my family to get here.
Hasnavi is on a State Department fellowship at the Harvard Kennedy School. I asked for volunteers from there and the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. Not that many people wanted to talk. Some students worried that sharing their perspectives could put their careers at risk. The handful who agreed had very personal reasons for choosing the Foreign Service, and they were resolute. Despite recent testimony by some officials who said they were cut out of the process by Trump political operatives, these future diplomats say they haven't lost faith in Foreign Service.
Not at all, no. Administrations change, the work of the Foreign Service doesn't.
They say that work, of being an individual face of the United States around the world, that still has power. Carlo James Aragon at Tufts Fletcher School has already served in embassies. He's from New Mexico, of Indo-Hispano and Filipino descent, and is fluent in Arabic,
Aragon says when he meets people abroad, it changes the way they see Americans.
People can start to see people of color representing a very powerful nation.
That's why being a diplomatic officer is worth it to him, even though he knows that he most likely will simply have to follow orders.
In diplomacy, we are asked to carry out the wishes of the administration, and we will. But if we are unable to, if we find a point that we're unable to ethically carry out, morally carry out these commands, then we have the responsibility to recuse ourselves or resign.
Or, perhaps, testify in Congress. That's got Aragon and other students thinking about their own so-called red lines, points at which they, too, would choose loyalty to the Constitution over loyalty to a president.
What they're learning and what we're trying to teach them is to gird themselves, to think about ahead of time, what are their red lines, what is their ethical code.
Monica Duffy-Toft is director of the Center for Strategic Studies at the Fletcher School. She says they're teaching students to thoroughly understand the agencies they'll serve and what their rights and responsibilities are.
So maybe this generation going in will say, we'll fight back maybe a little bit sooner than what we've seen so far.
But these diplomats in training may not have the same amount of guidance that past generations have had. Duffy-Toft says the State Department has been hollowed out. Many senior staff have left, and their positions remain unfilled.
And so what's going to happen is you're going to have this gap of professionalism. You're going to have a lot more political appointees who are not going to have the depth of expertise that we need in order to administer these agencies properly to protect the national interest.
Still, what some people see as a crisis, others see as democracy at work. Marina Kusuma Wardani is a student from Indonesia at the Harvard Kennedy School.
I know that in the U.S. people are sort of like complaining of what's happening, oh my God, the government. But you should also, in a way, be grateful for this process. It just like shows how healthy American democracy is.
Fellow Harvard student Heiner Sibirian agrees. His parents are from Mexico and El Salvador. He points out that there are ways to voice dissent within the State Department. He recalls when Thomas A. Shannon Jr. came to speak to students here. Shannon was Undersecretary for Political Affairs before leaving the State Department in 2017.
He said, the State Department, as a civilian agency, is an agency of debate. There's the ability to go up to your boss and say, hey, I'm not really clear on what the policy objective here is. I don't see how it aligns with our priorities. And so there's the ability to kind of work through the channel, the internal channels.
But all the students admit they don't really know what kinds of situations they'll face.
I just have a personal philosophy of not worrying until you have to.
So Mujib Hasnavi, the Harvard student whose family is from Russia and Afghanistan, he says he'll stay on the path he seems to have been on since before he was born, to join the State Department.
With so many people leaving, they have to be replaced and those positions have to be filled. So the work is even more pertinent now than it ever was before. And that just motivates me to get in as quickly as I can and do the work.
Especially now, he says, it's important to have dedicated people representing America's values abroad. Values that, Hasnavi says, haven't changed. For the World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Last year, an Indonesian passenger jet crashed into the Java Sea. All 189 people on board the Lion Air flight were killed. 5 months later, an Ethiopian Airlines flight also crashed. Again, everyone on board died, 157 people. Both planes were Boeing 737 MAX jets. Today, investigators in Indonesia issued a report about what caused the Lion Air crash and pointed to a serious design flaw. Airline pilot Patrick Smith explains what went wrong.
The airplane was sensing a condition that did not exist, an aerodynamic stall. And in response to that, it was pushing the nose down via this automated system that the pilots didn't really even know existed. And it kept engaging over and over, forcing the plane down, down, down. And the crew did not know how to properly disconnect the system and react to it in time to save the airplane. Now, the Indonesian report cites 9 different causes, both human and mechanical, that led to the crash. Ultimately, though, it comes down to this one system that was failing and wasn't understood by the crew. I mean, that's really the essence of it.
What were a few of those other variables that were interfering with the pilots as they were dealing with this plane continuously pointing downwards?
There were maintenance issues, ways in which the pilots reacted that weren't necessarily the right things to do in that circumstance. And that's kind of easy to analyze when you're an investigator looking back on something and you have all the time in the world, but these pilots were in this cockpit. The technology in front of them was failing. Alarms were sounding. Lights were flashing. The airplane doing things that it just wasn't supposed to be doing. And there were only seconds to save the day. And maybe they could have, but really, in essence, this is a design defect.
So let's zoom out here and talk about the 737 MAX. Some people say it was never really designed to do what Boeing wants it to do. Can you explain that?
This was an airplane conceived back in the 1960s to make short hops around Europe or the US, wherever. And Boeing has stuck by this basic template of a plane, and they've now created 10 different variants of it. And each one has gotten more sophisticated with bigger engines, fancier cockpit avionics, and so on. And they've pushed and pushed this thing. And the result, 5 decades on now, is this 737 MAX, which is kind of this monsterized hybrid of an airplane with all of this power and muscle and technology crammed into this 50-year-old framework.
What incentives does Boeing have to push this one line, the 737 MAX, to its limits?
It streamlines maintenance, it streamlines training, it streamlines just airline logistics. You know, it's a way of for airlines and the plane maker to save money. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but in this case, it's maybe resulted in them just pushing the line too long and too far.
Of course, now part of this whole story is that Boeing revealed that a pilot raised issues about the system as early as 2016, 2 years before the accidents. How damning do you think that is?
On the surface, you know, it's a pretty serious indictment. On the other hand, it's taken out of context. It's hard to say, but I think there's no denying here that the plane had a defect.
Has Boeing fixed the problems? Because they expect the 737 MAX to be back in the air by early next year.
From what I was reading today, a document that Boeing put out summarizing the steps they've taken, a number of software fixes, training enhancements for pilots, global fleet support. You know, the plane will be safe when it's back up in the air, but it's not necessarily easy to convince the average passenger of that. And is that going to result in the people refusing to fly on the airplane, airlines refusing to order the airplane? Those are open questions right now.
Patrick Smith is an airline pilot and runs the website askthepilot.com. Patrick, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
In the Canadian province of British Columbia, Indigenous people may soon be getting formal protections, legal commitments to end discrimination and ensure economic fairness.
Indigenous peoples have suffered historic injustices as a result of colonization and dispossession of their lands, their territories, and their resources.
That's Scott Fraser, a member of British Columbia's Legislative Assembly. He's also the legislative body's Minister of Indigenous Relations and Reconciliation. Yesterday, Fraser introduced a new bill.
I am proud to introduce Bill number 41, the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples Act. It's like a dream.
The rights of Indigenous people are protected under a UN agreement from 12 years ago. Canada signed on to that, but the UN Declaration is non-binding. Thus, British Columbia's push to codify things into formal law. Terry Teagy is the regional chief of the British Columbia Assembly of First Nations. Chief Teagy, thanks for being with us. How important is it that the provincial government of British Columbia has introduced this law?
This is a watershed moment. It's important to recognize that, and how decisions are being made must include First Nations, especially where it's directly affecting First Nations lives in terms of development and or social issues. Mm. It's quite important.
What does consent mean? I mean, what's it look like to you?
The way I see it is that there will be some sort of process where the provincial and the federal government come to the First Nations governance and all figure out how to best move forward and make a decision together.
So not just advice from Indigenous people, but actual legal consent.
Exactly.
What kind of projects are we talking about where First Nations communities in British Columbia could participate in the decision-making process?
Development here in British Columbia are industrial projects that have various types of agreements with Indigenous peoples. So for British Columbia, it would be mining, forestry, pipeline, what have been in discussion for a number of decades.
This doesn't mean, though, that First Nations could veto development projects, because that was a concern among some critics of this bill, right?
No, I don't think any governance, what we're saying here is that no government has a paramountcy or ability to veto a project. So I think this is what we've always asked for.
Chief TG, I'm wondering if there are Canadians who are bothered that British Columbia is acting so responsively to a UN declaration that is non-binding.
Well, I think there will be, I suppose, criticism of this legislation, in particular from perhaps industry not fully knowing what consent means. And I suppose there's going to be some naysayers out there. I mean, on all sides, that will state that it doesn't go far enough or that it, you know, is infringing on some sort of right. So I think this really has been in development, the declaration itself, before it was passed in 2007 for 20, 25 years. And it has been debated, has been brought to the UN a number of times. And on an international level, it's just the minimum standards of human rights.
Do you hope that other Indigenous people around the world see the example being set in British Columbia and will mobilize to follow what you're doing?
Yes, I think British Columbia is a unique place. Much of the court cases that have been won by Indigenous people in Canada have come from British Columbia. It's tough to start building a new path, a new journey in terms of our relationship with colonial governments. So we certainly hope that by leading the way that other First Nations in Canada and perhaps United States can really see the example of British Columbia, see this as an example and a way to move forward with changing the relationship with their government.
Terry Teagee, a member of Takla Lake First Nation and the regional chief of the British Columbia Assembly of First Nations. Good to speak with you. Thanks, Chief Teagee.
Thank you. You're welcome.
For Indigenous people in Australia, the massive red sandstone monolith known as Uluru is a sacred place. Elevation about 3,000 feet, a big table rock of a mountain. Aboriginal people never walk or climb on it, so the fact that Uluru has long been a destination for climbers has been a source of pain. Teresa Nipper is an Aboriginal elder.
So we respect Ngoranyangaja. Tourists Rabijala enjoy the rock and walk around, not sit on it. Step on it. You're hurting the rock. It's so special to us.
The Aboriginal people living nearby are not just the spiritual guardians of Uluru, they're the owners. And after a long campaign, climbing on Uluru is now banned. The rule took effect today. Mike Misso is the manager of Uluru National Park.
Look, it's like a lot of places around the world. It's a bit of a, maybe they see it as a sense of achievement and it's, wow, let's climb Uluru on the bucket list. But over many years, numbers of people wanting to climb has actually declined.
In the days running up to the ban, Uluru did see a spike in tourists trying to get in one final climb or a first climb, like this woman and her boyfriend.
Oh, I think it is probably disrespectful, but we climbed yesterday only because it's been our dream to do it. Our parents both did it on the same day and they didn't know each other. Once you got there, it was incredible. It was spiritual when you get up the top, and my boyfriend did propose, so I think it was a pretty good experience.
Yeah, pretty good experience for that couple. But now that Uluru is off limits to climbers, one Aboriginal elder said it's time to let the rock rest and heal. In Iraq, we're seeing something that's playing out in many places across the globe, protests. People there chanted, "If 10 of us die, if 100 of us die, we won't give up the cause." Demonstrators approached the Green Zone in Baghdad today, where foreign embassies and government buildings are based. Those protesters were met with tear gas. At least two people were killed today. More than 150 have died since the protests began earlier this month. Most of the protesters are under 35 years of age. They want jobs, better public services, and an end to government corruption.
And they demand their share in living a dignified, good life. And they demand their share in the country's resources.
Sinan Antoun is an Iraqi writer and poet. He now lives in New York, but was in Iraq earlier this year. Sinan told me life has become unbearable for Iraqis.
What motivates these young men and women in Iraq is that Iraq is one of the richest countries in terms of its oil reserves. Yet they're not getting anything out of that, which is simply not fair. So it's about justice and dignity.
What do they actually want?
They actually want this entire political system to go away. They want the government to resign. They want new elections. They want a new constitution. I mean, they have been using the slogan that we've seen in other Arab revolts, which is they want the fall of the regime. They are fed up and tired and have lost all hope that this regime can actually reform itself.
I mean, despite the stance by the Iraqi government, they also are concerned about the future. Laith Kuba, an advisor to Iraq's prime minister, said that if the government did not act to meet some of the demonstrators' demands, the government might not survive.
I do believe if the promises and the pledges are not met, and if there is no significant shift in its politics, I think this government will be forced to resign.
Sinan Antoun, just yesterday you wrote an item for Al Jazeera where you said that the Iraqi political system is, quote, beyond reform or repair. Why do you think that is?
You know, because since 2002, I mean, I've been hearing and Iraqis have been hearing and seeing these people talking about building a new state and so on and so forth. And last night, the Iraqi prime minister gave a speech where he said, we promise to build a modern state. I mean, it's been 16 years. So if a group has 16 years and it has not delivered anything, that's it. This system is corrupt. It has a congenital defect from day one, from 2003 in the U.S. occupation, putting in place an ethno-sectarian system and populating the regime with people who have, many of whom have no constituency inside Iraq.
So Sinan Antoun, you've got this novel out, The Book of Collateral Damage. I'm wondering if there's anything in this book that speaks to, you know, what's happening right now in Iraq with these protests, so many young men frustrated with lack of jobs, opportunities, and, of course, the political corruption in the system there.
Yes, I mean, the novel has two characters, one an Iraqi living in New York and another an Iraqi living in Baghdad who has to suffer and survive war and the aftermath of war. And everything that dictatorship and then the U.S. occupation and the regime it put in place has brought. And so living with the continuous death of loved ones. And there's this one part where a character is elegizing his loved one who died in a terrorist attack, which is part of the corruption that these young protesters are angry about. So I'll just read a bit in Arabic and then the translation in English, which is done by Jonathan Wright. منذ سنين والخراب والموت يتناوبان على صفع وجوهنا ووجوه مدننا كل صباح يشطبان الأسماء كلها أسماء الأمكنة والأحبة واحدا بعد الآخر تارة يشطبان بالأحمر القاني الذي يبقي الجراح مفتوحة وتارة أخرى بالأسود الذي يعمي شمس العراق ويطيل ليله الطويل. For years, death and destruction have taken turns slapping us and our cities every morning. They erase all names, the names of places and loved ones, one after another. Sometimes they erase them with the blood-red color that leaves wounds open, at others with the black that blocks out the Iraqi sun and makes its long night even longer. Yes, Abu Tayyib, you saw Iraq when its night was long, and now it's longer than ever. A night that now descends sadly on your street, which they have stabbed with fire along with my friend who lived in its heart. Wadud, another name to be added to the thousands upon thousands of Iraqi dead, marching into the twilight of oblivion and silence. But wait, do I not have the right to stop the procession for a few minutes to bid farewell to my friend? I chose this excerpt in particular because in the last 12 hours, the Iraqi regime or its militias have killed two young men who were just demonstrating peacefully and is using all of its power to suppress all of these young men.
Iraqi writer and poet Sinan Antoun, his new novel is called The Book of Collateral Damage. Sinan, thank you very much for speaking with us. Good to have you on the show again.
Thank you for the opportunity. It's an honor and a pleasure.
We've been covering protests across the globe all week, from Iraq to Hong Kong to Santiago, Chile, and Barcelona. Earlier today, we heard from an activist in Lebanon. Demonstrations there began as a protest against a proposed tax on WhatsApp. It's led to violence in the streets. But DJ Mahdi is trying to keep things cool. Because of him, some protests in Tripoli and Beirut have turned into street parties. We reached out to DJ Mahdi via Twitter and asked him what's been on his playlist. He tweeted back a favorite song for this revolution. It's a tune Ense, or Forget It, by Mohammed Ramadan and Saad Lamjared. So we end the week with a track from DJ Mahdi, Selecta of the Lebanese Uprising. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Have a great weekend. We'll be back with you on Monday.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.